Slate's coverage of food systems is made possible in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Welcome to Slate's Table to Farm. I'm Laura Anderson, Slate's food and drink editor. And joining me here in New York is Dan Pashman, the host of the Sporkful Food Podcast. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Laura.
So each week on this podcast, we start at our table, we choose a food or ingredient, then we investigate where it comes from, and finally we cook it and eat it. Today we are going to talk about pork.
That's right, and I love pork.
That's funny because I love pigs.
You love them so much that you refuse to eat them.
Exactly. Actually, the story in my family is that I chose to become a vegetarian when we were like on this family road trip going through Oklahoma, and we passed by this barbecue restaurant that had a giant sign with a picture of a pig on it, and I like made the connection that like, oh my God, barbecue is made out of pigs. And after that, I refused to eat meat.
Well, that's interesting because I happen to have a rule that I think that barbecue restaurants are especially promising when they have a pig mascot.
Oh, why is that?
I don't know. It's just a connection that I've made. I think, like, if you have a pig in sunglasses or a smiling pig statue out in front.
Pig waving.
Pig waving. Yeah. That's it's not 100%, but in my experience, that bodes well.
See, I just think pigs are incredibly cute. And once you see a picture of an anthropomorphized pig, then I don't understand how you can then go on to eat that animal's flesh when you see how adorable it is.
Well, that's something we can explore in this episode.
Why are pigs so cute?
Yeah. And delicious at the same time.
Right.
The pig paradox.
So later in the show, we're going to talk to someone who makes a lot of different pork products about why it's possible to make so many different kinds of food from a single pig. But to start out, we wanted to learn more about raising pigs and what kind of animals pigs are. So joining us now from Bolinas, California, are Bill Nyman and Nicolette Hahn Nyman. They are the owners and operators of Bee Inn Ranch. Nicolette is a lawyer and the author of Righteous Pork Chop, and Bill is the founder of the natural meat company Nyman Ranch, Incorporated, and he used to raise pigs. Bill and Nicolette, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
So if I had to hazard a guess, I would say that most of our listeners have probably never met a pig and therefore have no idea what pigs do with their time and what their personalities are like. So can you start out by telling us a little bit about what are some things about pigs that might surprise people?
Well, for me, they're the most interesting animal in the barnyard, and it is so interesting and so compelling to watch that it's really hard to tear yourself away from a fence line while you're observing them. Their eyes are identical to ours, so it's just easy to kind of communicate with them. When you look into their eye, it's much easier to read what they're thinking, what their emotions are. They're so clever, and they figure things out so quickly. The equipment that you use to husband pigs, for example, the feeders or the waterers, they all require activities. You know, you have to open the door to get to the feed, or you have to do something special with the drinking device in order for them to get a drink. And these are things that no other animals in the barnyard can master or figure out. Even a dog has trouble with them. You've probably also heard the cliche that pigs are the cleanest animal in the barnyard. Well, they are the only animal in the barnyard that will defecate in a specific area. So they will not mess their pens. As far as the mud goes, what people don't understand, it's not because they like being dirty, but pigs lack sweat glands. So for them to cool themselves in the summer, they need to actually get wet or get in some mud, and that really helps to cool their bodies and maintain a cooler body temperature.
So, Nicolette, can you tell us a little bit more about what industrial pork production is like and how exactly it stymies natural behaviors and instincts of pigs?
Yeah, well, when I was the senior attorney for Waterkeeper Alliance, I had the opportunity to tour quite a few of these big industrial confinement operations raising pigs. They keep the animals continually confined in a building. The floor is perforated in some way, and what that does, it allows the urine and the manure to go from where the animal is standing to underneath the building, and they'll never be outside. They'll never be, you know, in sunshine or breathing fresh air. They'll never have exercise. You'll never see any pigs playing together. It's a total contrast to when you visit a farm where the animals are out in pasture and the piglets are running around and rolling in the grass, a lot like puppies. You'll never see anything like that in a confinement building. You'll very often see them chewing on the bars. the metal bars, or you'll see them kind of waving their heads. And these are these have been acknowledged to be behaviors typical of people that are very mentally disturbed, humans. And the sows are basically going insane in these crates. I mean, it's really obvious even to just a layperson to see that. So they're very depressing places.
What are some of the issues of sustainability that relate specifically to pigs, or that are bigger concerns with pigs than with other animals?
Well, it's interesting because pigs were not a major environmental problem historically. When they were more dispersed, you know, on lots of farms and, you know, in smaller herds. But now, because pigs are raised in total confinement, the herd size has shifted from, you know, 50 to 50,000. And there are some really big operations that have upwards of a million pigs in one location. So what that means is not just that you have this tremendous concentration of the manure, but because of these operations being total confinement and the animals always being in one place, they have to liquefy the manure. So it kind of makes it like a sewage system so that they can move the manure through pipes and move it around on the operation. So the manure is in a more volatile state. It's more likely to run off. It's more likely to drip down into groundwater, and it's more likely to get into the air as well. So that, from an environmental perspective, this is a whole new threat that never existed before related to farming, and especially to pig farming.
Bill, you're the founder of Nyman Ranch Incorporated, which is now a network of about 700 farms and ranches. It's known for providing pork to Chipotle, and it's also just kind of known as like a seal of approval. You see Nyman Ranch on menus as a sort of indicator that the meat comes from a good source. But you're no longer affiliated with Nyman Ranch. Can you talk about why you parted ways with the company that you founded and that's named after you?
Over time, as Nyman Ranch grew, and I'm very proud of that, and became a national brand, we took a lot of investment capital in to grow the business. As new owners and new leadership came on board, they felt the opportunity was to be a marketer as opposed to a producer or farmer. So as my focus was the beef, the company decided they didn't want to own cattle. They didn't want to own a feedlot. They didn't really want to take responsibility for caring for animals and raising them to the highest possible standard. I'm no longer involved, after my departure in 2006.
Do you feel like that company is still doing a pretty good job of upholding the standards that you set for it?
I think they are on the pork side of the business. The beef side is a different story.
Okay. What I think is interesting, one of the sort of recurring themes about this series that Laura and I have been working on is that on one hand, there's increasing concern for sustainability, local. But in truth, today as we sit here, it's still something of a niche movement, and it's growing. But at a certain point, it's just a question of, can it scale? Can it scale up to the level where this could become the way food is produced for the majority of Americans? And it seems like what happened with Nyman Ranch for you is that those two things eventually came into conflict, to keep the standards up and to produce enough to make as much money as the company wanted to make. Those two things became mutually exclusive. I'd like to hear from both of you. Bill, first, how do you feel about that tension between the need for more and trying to uphold certain standards?
Well, I think it may come down to what is considered a reasonable return on investment. There's no doubt in my mind that animal-based food enterprises can be scaled to feed the entire population, and it can be done so profitably and environment in a sustainable, kind of sensible way. But can it be done to at the maximum level of return on investment? I don't think so. It just has to be looked at as a more sensible, long-term investment.
So now, Nicolette, I want to hear from you, but we should the surprise turn in our story comes right now at this moment, because part of this cattle ranching, formerly pig raising couple, you, Nicolette, you're a vegetarian.
Yes, it is unusual to be a rancher that's a vegetarian. I actually do think my vegetarianism is relevant here, because I've lived for 25 years without eating meat, so I'm very aware that it can be done. I actually am a big believer in animal-based foods as part of the human diet. I think that creates the optimal human diet when some animal-based foods are included in it. However, it's clear that modern Western societies are eating far more than is necessary or probably even beneficial for human health. So part of the solution in this whole issue is that, you know, Americans and other people, you know, eating the Western diet around the world should scale back some of their animal-based food consumption, whether it's dairy or eggs or meat. It's been shown that, you know, you could mathematically, it is possible to produce as much beef and pork and all the other foods, animal-based foods in the United States, as we are raising today, and to do so sustainably. That could be done, but I don't even think that's advisable.
Nicolette, I wanted to get back to the question of your vegetarianism.
Okay.
So I'm also a vegetarian, and I think I have a similar view to you in that I don't think that eating meat is bad per se. But I feel like I could never personally kill an animal. I just don't think I would be able to do that. And that's one reason that I feel like I shouldn't be eating meat, because I don't think that I could look an animal in the face and then kill it. And so I'm curious if in your role as a rancher, you have personally killed animals, if you've seen animals being killed, and if that has at all affected your ideas about vegetarianism.
No, but I think that, I mean, okay, first of all, I have not personally slaughtered animals. We don't do that on the ranch. They're all slaughtered. Everything we raise is slaughtered with either Bill or one of our partners in our business present, but at a professional slaughter plant. Part of the reason I have really been very comfortable with what we're doing is that I know that there's this attention being given to the slaughter process. But, you know, for me, you know, I've always thought of humans as, you know, an animal that is part of an ecosystem, a large, you know, planetary ecosystem, local ecosystem, whatever. And, you know, animals eat other animals, and animals eat plants, and they eat other animals as part of a natural ecosystem. And when they die, their bodies are returned to Earth, and they become food for the subsequent generations. So I think, you know, individual humans can make a choice. My choice is, as you were saying, Laura, it's kind of like that. I feel like I don't want to look an animal in the eye and take its life. Me personally, and so that's a lot of the reason I refrain from eating meat. The other thing is that I don't ever desire meat. You know, I think that if I did, I would eat it.
And Bill, I'm curious to ask you, you talked at the outset about the strong, I would call it a bond, that you have felt with pigs that you have raised. Nicolette talked about her feelings towards the actual slaughtering of the animals. How do you feel when pigs that you've raised are brought to slaughter?
Well, this is a question that's often asked, Dan, and it's really difficult for, you know, lay people to understand how a farmer or rancher can treat their animals with dignity and respect and love them, if you will, and then take them to slaughter. Well, it doesn't get easier with numbers if you're at all have any sensitivity to other living creatures and appreciate the power of dominion over other creatures and controlling their life and death. So it's a difficult moment, but when the animal is transformed from a living creature to something that's going to feed people, and then you share that with people, it's just a huge payback and reward. And this is what motivates thinking and conscious animal farmers, is that they are feeding people, and they want to feed people something that's wholesome and wonderful and delicious. And that joy overcomes the pain of having to actually take their lives. So the important thing is that is done well and done right. And I couldn't help but think when Laura was describing it, that she felt, if I'm, and to paraphrase, if I'm going to eat meat, I want to look that animal in the eye, or I want to be responsible or take charge of its slaughter. And I felt the same way at time, but now I realize that it's, as in all things in our society, we have divisions of labor, and those people who know how to do that and do that well should take responsibility for that, because it's so important that it be done correctly, both safely and humanely, and that those who are not in that position should feel okay about delegating that. So, Laura, come around. Don't worry about it.
We're not trying to convert vegetarians. Bill has never tried to convert me, I have to say, in all the years that we've known each other, and I give him a lot of credit for that.
That is another recurring theme of our series. I'm always trying to dangle some meat in front of Laura.
For this episode of our podcast, we are going to be cooking some kind of pork dish. And Dan will be eating it, and I won't because I don't eat meat. But I'm curious, Bill, do you have a favorite way to prepare pork?
Well, slow and easy. And I really prefer the shoulder meat. And the pork butt is really my favorite part of the animal. And
pork butt is?
Is part of the shoulder. It's basically the equivalent of the chuck in beef. And because it's one of the more active muscles, it has a lot more connective tissue and collagen, and those things add great flavor. But if you eat carnitas,
yes,
if you eat carnitas at Chipotle, that's made from pork butt and pork shoulder primarily. So maybe that'll help you understand.
I'm a huge fan of carnitas. That's probably my number one pork dish with a crispy skin. Oh, it's so good, right?
Exactly.
Bill Nyman and Nicolette Han Nyman are the owners and operators of B&N Ranch in Bolinas, California, and Nicolette is the author of Righteous Pork Chop. Bill and Nicolette, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you,
Dan and Laura.
Well, Laura, I think that Bill Nyman made the decision or helped me make the decision. I think we're going to have to cook up some pork butt, and I'm very excited to eat it.
All right. I'm glad you're excited.
I am curious to get your thoughts on Bill's response to your statement regarding eating animals. You basically said, if I'm going to eat it, I should have the guts to kill it. And he basically said, in society, we have division of labor. Slaughtering is very important, and there's nothing wrong with delegating that responsibility to someone who's an expert at it and who's going to do it properly. How do you feel about that?
Well, I certainly take his point that we shouldn't have amateurs running around killing animals and that someone who's going to kill animals for meat should be an expert at it. But I think for me, it's not only that I couldn't kill a pig or another animal myself. It's that I would be traumatized even witnessing someone kill that animal. And I think that like if I just have this kind of emotional, visceral reaction to the idea of killing an animal for food that I think is a good reason for me not to eat meat personally. I think that generally we have too much separation between, I mean, this is not an original thought. We have too much separation between people who consume meat and the people who actually raise animals for food and kill those animals. And so, yes, I think that we should have a sort of more integrated system in which people who eat meat are, I don't want to say forced to think about where it comes from, but people who eat meat should have a better idea of where it comes from. And people who eat meat should at least know who it is that is killing their animals and how it is that the animals that they eat are killed and raised. I don't think that that's too much to ask.
No, I think that's fair. And I think the Nymans would probably agree.
Okay, so pork butt, huh?
That's right.
But there are so many different kinds of pork products that you could have. You could make sausage, you could have ham, bacon, obviously, it's sort of like very popular pig ingredient.
I am on record as saying that while bacon is delicious, it is overrated. And so I am not going to cook bacon. I also have a difficult situation because my wife was raised in a kosher home and we have this sort of tenuous compromise whereby I've agreed not to cook pork in my home. So even cooking this pork butt is going to be a bit of a challenge, but I'll work it out.
That must be so rough for you.
I mean, I still eat it out, and I will occasionally get takeout and bring it in and eat it on a paper plate. But yeah, it is difficult. It's my favorite meat, and I don't cook it at home. But, you know, the things we do for love of pork and people.
So joining us now to talk a little bit more about all the different kinds of pork products that are out there is Michael Yezzi. Michael is the owner of Flying Pigs Farm in Shusha, New York. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. Looking forward to talking about pigs today.
So are we. So let's talk a little bit about breeds of pig. You raise three rare breeds of pig on your farm, large blacks, Gloucestershire Old Spots, and Tamworths. Can you talk a little bit about the effect of breeds on the flavor of the final pork product?
We raise, as you said, rare heritage breed pigs. So a heritage breed pig is a pig that was around 150, 200 years ago. And a rare breed pig is ones with worldwide populations of between 2 and 5,000. And they have not been selected for sort of the industrial model and haven't been put through that process of being leaned out and standardized and bred to grow fast. So they haven't had all the fat and flavor bred out of them, because Americans recently in the last, 20, 30 years have been getting away from fat, and in pork it's resulted in very lean product, and that sort of resulted in what many people find are sort of a bland, dry product, to the point where it has to be injected with salt water so that it has a chance of being moist once it's cooked.
Can you tell the difference between, say, the meat of a large black and the meat of a Tamworth?
I can, but mostly from appearance. The Tamworths are what traditionally have been called a bacon pig, where a large black was a lard pig. A lot of people today would say, why would you want a lard pig? Why would you want something that has so much fat?
Why wouldn't you want a lard pig?
That's what I say.
And it's coming back, Michael. I was actually at an event a few months back called the Lard Exoneration Dinner. And I was there with my friend Robert Smith, who turned it into a great piece that he did for NPR's Planet Money, all about the intentional vilification of lard in the early part of the 20th century by Procter & Gamble with an assist from Upton Sinclair, and how lard is really not actually any worse for you than any other animal fat, and actually much better for baking and various other uses.
That's definitely true. I'm glad to hear that after all these years, lard has finally gotten clemency.
Yeah. I want to ask you, Michael, about what pigs eat, because I think that's an interesting thing. There's so much is made with cows about corn-fed versus grass-fed, and we hear with pigs, people talk about acorn-fed pork. But traditionally, pigs were kind of an animal that was fed whatever was lying around. So if you assume that you're not feeding pigs anything that's going to make them sick, within the realm of things that they can digest without trouble, does it really matter what pigs eat?
It matters what they eat. The food that they're eating creates flavors in the meat. Fish oil is used as a protein supplement in pig feed. But if you don't discontinue that a few months before slaughter, the pork tastes fishy.
But in the sense of you talk about how things have been changed in recent years with the industrialization of pork, that in many ways, as we've heard, that the way that pigs are treated has changed. But 100 years ago on farms in America, pigs were fed kind of whatever was lying around. Like that's the traditional way. Is that right?
It is. Pigs are omnivores. They'll eat anything. And unlike beef or sheep, which are ruminants, which have multiple stomachs, pigs are single-gutted like we are. They're actually very similar to people, so similar that you can use pig heart valves for humans in heart surgery. So we give them free choice corn and soy mixed with minerals so that they get a balanced nutrients. But I'm looking at them right now out through the window, and they're just rooting around, chomping on the last bits of grass that have been uncovered by the melting snow.
You've already mentioned a few different pork products. What is it about a pig's anatomy that allows it to be turned into so many different kinds of products?
It's a relatively mild meat. When you raise them outside, it's not bland, but it's not as strong as, say, mutton or even grass-fed beef. You're able to impart a wide variety of styles of cooking, whether it's Asian or barbecue, and sort of the whole range of tastes.
What are some cuts or preparations of pork that you think are especially underrated, people don't know about, but you think they might want to check out?
I think pork shanks are great. They are not often used, mostly turned into sausage, but most people know about the hock, the pork hock, and find those smoked. And that's just sort of the joint, the knee joint of the pig. But just above that, as you go up the leg, is the shank. And then it turns into the shoulder.
Flying Pigs also makes many, many kinds of sausage. And I know that the cliche is that you don't want to know how your sausage is made, but I want to know how your sausage is made. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Sure. We have about 14 kinds of sausage, and that's sort of my best effort to keep it at a minimum. we use the trim from all the other cuts when we butcher the pigs. So if we are taking pork chops and there's a little bit of meat that needs to be taken off to clean it up, that goes into a pile. If we're making cutlets out of the rear leg or making boneless hams and there are some little pieces that need to be taken off just to make the presentation better, those will go, we'll save those, and that'll go into the sausage. We don't do any mechanically extruding, no pink slime or similar things. It's just the, if you looked at it, it would look like stew meat. And then we balance the lean and the fat so we get the a ratio that is moist and flavorful, because fat is flavor, but not so much that it winds up shrinking up and you're left with a lot of oil in the pan and not much sausage.
Are there parts of the pig that you think are not fit to be used?
There's the old saying that you can eat everything but the squeal. we have customers who make head cheese, and they'll take the whole head, and they'll boil it and reserve the liquid and chop it up and put it into a roll, a tureen, and add some of the liquid, and you have a great head cheese. We have people who use the pig's feet, the heart, the liver, the kidneys.
Michael, Laura might not have mentioned that she's a vegetarian, but I wish that you could have seen her face while you were describing head cheese. That was pretty priceless.
It's just hard to imagine that after you've seen the head of a pig boiling in water that you could ever possibly want to eat it. But I guess that just goes to show why I'm a vegetarian.
but once you taste it, it's...
Right. The taste is so powerful that it erases your sight memory.
Michael has a recipe for pork butt that we're going to put on our show page at slate.com/tabletofarm. Michael Yezzi is the owner of Flying Pigs Farm in Shushan, New York. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great fun talking about pigs.
Dan, you're glowing. You look so happy.
I am very happy. This is quite delicious. It's just so soft and tender and delectable. I mean, I just love pigs. I love pigs. You and I both love pigs, Laura. We both love pigs.
We just love them in slightly different ways.
That's right.
So tell me a little bit about this recipe that you chose from Michael's website.
Well, they have two on their website, one for pork shoulder or butt with garlic and thyme, one that's cider braised. And I know that apple sauce and apple preparations with pork are common. I'm not the biggest fan of fruit with my pork. I don't love especially sweet pork seasonings. I like the pork's natural sweetness. I don't mind a little sweetness in my barbecue sauce, but I don't love a lot of barbecue sauce on pork either. So that's why I went with the garlic one, and it's delicious. I mean, it's really the meat is the star. So I don't think people should get too hung up on exactly how they want to cook it. You get a good pork shoulder or pork butt, you cook it slow and low. And, I mean, it's really, like, you would have to go out of your way to make it come out poorly. So this is soft, it's tender, it's juicy. Why don't you talk for a minute, because I want to have another bite. Stop making me talk.
All right. It's clear that Dan is otherwise occupied right now, so I think that about does it for us this week. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Laura.
Dan's food podcast is called The Sporkful. You can search for it on iTunes or find it at sporkful.com. You can also get Michael Yezzi's recipe for pork butt with garlic and thyme and find other links from today's show on our show page at slate.com/tabletofarm.
Yeah, we'll link to that NPR Planet Money story that Robert Smith did all about lard and how it's really great and people shouldn't be against it.
I'm really looking forward to listening to that. You should join us next week when we'll be talking about bread, which it seems like is the only thing that is missing from your meal right now, Dan.
Yeah, although I don't even like a lot of bread with my pork. I'm not a big fan of the pulled pork sandwich. Pulled pork is good. I just want to eat the pulled pork. I don't want it covered in coleslaw and barbecue sauce and vinegar. The pork is the star, people.
Well, I'm sorry to have to put you through an entire episode dedicated to bread instead of pork. I know that you really just want to do another episode about pork next week.
No, I like bread, too. It's okay. I'll enjoy the bread.